Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast, powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming to you from our partially acoustically baffled studio in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm joined, as always, by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
And from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy.
Hello, George.
All right. We are coming off an eventful 72 hours in the Florida governor's race. Two debates between Democrat Andrew Gillum and Republican Ron DeSantis. And in between those debates, the release of 150 pages of subpoenaed documents from a state ethics investigation that raised some questions about Gillum's dealings with a lobbyist friend and with a undercover FBI agent. We'll be talking about that. But let's talk about those debates and kind of set the table for it. When you think back on major elections and try to put a coherent narrative on what happened after the fact, there's a tendency to point to a dramatic moment or two in a debate and say that was a turning point. I'm not sure how true that actually is, especially now that the elections take place over several weeks. Here in Florida, as we tape this podcast, more than 1.7 million people have already voted in Florida. And of those that haven't voted and haven't made up their minds, we don't know how many of them actually watched the governor debates and with an eye on making a decision. But let's stick with the coherent narrative idea, at least for a while. We're going to listen to a couple of clips of legendary debate moments, one from a presidential debate, one from a Florida gubernatorial debate. The first, Thomas Cordy is going to queue up. He's going to earn his pay today because we got some good audio in the lineup here. The first one is from Ronald Reagan's closing argument in his only debate with Jimmy Carter before the 1980 presidential election.
Next Tuesday is election day. Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls. You'll stand there in the polling place and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
Okay, memorable moment from the Gipper. That was also the debate where he said, where Jimmy Carter criticized him on Medicare, and Reagan kind of shook his head and laughed and said, there you go again. We don't have the audio for that. We just have me imitating it. So the are you better off line, I don't know how pivotal that actually was. But after the fact, when you look at the 1980 election, that line from Reagan kind of encapsulates what that whole election was about. The next one we're going to hear from is from 1994, right here in Florida. And there was the election that year between Democratic Governor Lawton Chiles and his Republican challenger, Jeb Bush, who had been bashing Chiles throughout the campaign as a liberal. And towards the end of the campaign at a debate in Tampa, Lawton Chiles said this.
My mama told me sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. But let me tell you one other thing about the old liberal. The old he coon walks just before the light of day.
All right. The old he-coon walks just before the light of day. Now, Lawton Chiles is a legendary, revered figure in Florida politics, but I have to confess that at the time and even to this day, I don't really get the whole he-coon remark, but he won the race, and it's held up as this great example of a wily Florida cracker throwing down some folksy wisdom. So there you are. That's a memorable moment. I think, if Bush had won that race, you'd probably play that same clip and say that was the moment Florida voters concluded Chiles was off his rocker. But either way, that's kind of the windup. And we're going to talk now about current events, about the DeSantis-Gillum debates. But first, I think I hear some kind of funky royalty-free music playing. Listeners to the podcast know that music means it is time for our pick a number segment. That's where each of us will put forward a number, and later on in the podcast, we will explain what that number means in Florida politics. John Kennedy, what's the number you've brought to today's podcast?
George, I have brought number 107. 107.
107 for John Kennedy. Okay, good number. Zach Anderson over in Sarasota, do you have a number for us, and what is it?
I'm going with a 54, George. I've been going kind of low lately, so I'm bumping it up.
All right, 54 for Zach Anderson. And my number is 63.2. So if you're keeping notes, and as always, we do encourage note-taking as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery. If you're taking notes, those numbers again are from John Kennedy, 107, from Zach Anderson, 54, and from George Bennett, that's me, 63.2. Now, you're going to want to hang on to every word that we utter in the podcast, and then at the end, you'll hear what those numbers mean in Florida politics. But let's get back to our loaded lineup this today. Talking about the Gillum-DeSantis debates, you know, we heard the Reagan and the Childs clips that are looked back upon after the fact as being kind of defining or critical moments in those debates. We don't know who's going to win the governor's race here in Florida, so we're going to have to do some kind of advance hindsight, pre-hindsight, for both DeSantis and Gillum. So first, if DeSantis ends up winning this election, Thomas Cordy is going to play two clips in succession. One is from Sunday's debate, and then after the big document dump on Tuesday, a clip of DeSantis from Wednesday night. And these, again, might be looked back upon as being significant if DeSantis wins the race.
Did you pay for the Hamilton ticket, or did the undercover FBI pay for the Hamilton ticket? Did you pay to stay in the villa in Costa Rica? Where are the receipts? You have not proven that you paid for anything, and that's the problem.
When I worked with the FBI, I was doing it as a prosecutor to bring people to justice. When Andrew is dealing with the FBI, he's dealing with an undercover agent as a person of interest in investigation. Now think about what he wants you to believe. He wants you to believe that he's not under investigation. Why would an undercover FBI agent posing as a contractor give him a $1,000 ticket to Hamilton? And so he was asked the question by me, did you pay for it? He was indignant. He said, I'm a grown man. I pay for my stuff. He lied the other day. The text messages show he knew it came from Mike Miller, who he didn't know was an undercover FBI agent at the time, but now we know that. He also didn't tell the truth about the junket he took in Costa Rica.
Okay, that was Ron DeSantis going after Andrew Gillum about his Hamilton ticket and trip to Costa Rica. Next, we're going to hear from Andrew Gillum. If he wins the election, I think this is this clip we're going to hear is going to be remembered as a big moment. And it's remember we played that Lawton Childs He Coon clip, and this is Gillum doing the folksy rhetoric thing, and I would argue in a more intelligible fashion than Lawton Childs did. Go ahead,
Let
Thomas.
Let me first say, my grandmother used to say a hit dog will holler, and it hollered through this room. Mr. DeSantis has spoken. First of all, he's got neo-Nazis helping him out in this state. He has spoken at racist conferences. He's accepted a contribution and would not return it from someone who referred to the former president of the United States as a Muslim, N-I-G-G-E-R. When asked to return that money, he said no. He's using that money to now fund negative ads. Now, I'm not calling Mr. DeSantis a racist. I'm simply saying the racists believe he's a racist.
All right. A couple of strong moments from each of the candidates. Zach Anderson, you covered the Sunday debate and watched the Wednesday debate. What's your takeaway from these debates?
Well, I think they were really good debates, actually. I think these are two of the better debates that I've watched. So that's kind of the bigger picture. I mean, both of these candidates are very strong debaters. They're both very articulate and aggressive and quick on their feet and able to really change between any issue and any subject quickly. So I thought these were informative debates. They really went at each other. I thought the first debate on CNN was a little bit better. The moderator, Jake Tapper, did a good job of just sort of facilitating and kind of staying out of the way a little bit and letting the candidates really go after each other. Whereas I think the second debate, there was a little bit more stopping and starting. But in terms of a moment or two that stood out, I think, you know, for Gillum, to me, you know, it's interesting. DeSantis has really tried to paint him as sort of in dark terms, as somebody who would be dangerous for the state, as somebody who is soft on crime and, you know, because of, you know, the crime rate in Tallahassee and other issues. And I think that Gillum, you know, was successful in defending himself a little bit, especially when DeSantis went after him on the immigration issue and tried to say that he would be soft on illegal immigrants and that he would even release, you know, allow child molesters to be released into the community because he wouldn't crack down on illegal immigration. And Gillum came back and said, shame on you. I absolutely would corroborate. And how can you expect you to be honest with the people of the state of Florida if you can't be honest with them about my record? And then he said, you're disqualified, in my opinion, from the office of governor. And I think, you know, DeSantis might have gone a little bit too far with trying to paint Gillum as somebody who would release child molesters, and you know, might have undercut his argument a little bit in that case.
Okay. John Kennedy, you were around a working journalist, as was I, back in the Lawton Chiles Hikun remark. Maybe you can shed a little light on that. More importantly, what your thoughts were on the this week's Gillum DeSantis debates.
Well, that Lawton Chiles comment at the time was really one that, you know, baffled most people that listened to it. But
so it wasn't just me that was confused by that, in other words.
No, I don't think so. I think it was most of the audience. But it was one of those things that came after Jeb Bush had spoken Spanish in a debate as well. So you had Chiles drawing a little bit of a contrast to the people that he was speaking to and seeking to get to support him in that reelection campaign, where he was able to bring in a lot of the old blue-collar, cracker Florida Democrats that were still out there and were tending to vote Republican. Nowadays, they pretty much are on the side of the Republican candidate in most statewide races. But, you know, Gillum may have tried his own attempt at sending a signal to voters with some of his comments there that were very folksy and kind of aimed at, you know, perhaps the minority community in some respects to sort of power what is expected to be a very strong turnout for him. But you had DeSantis, too, also using a lot of code words that were able to drive maybe people that he wants to bring in. He talked about, you know, for one thing, you know, that Gillum had signed a manifesto with a what he describes as a radical group, what DeSantis says is a radical group, the Dream Defenders, which are a kind of a social advocacy organization that Gillum has been allied with. Terms like manifesto just build into that whole thing about, you know, Gillum has this socialist plan for healthcare and state government in general, that he's going to raise taxes. DeSantis raised the idea that Gillum would take away guns, that he is hostile to the Second Amendment. A lot of stuff like that, that, you know, at this point in the debates, DeSantis has nothing to lose, I guess, by becoming very aggressive.
Manifesto is one of those words. If your writings are ever described as a manifesto, it's not a good thing. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, were they able to accomplish each of them what they needed to accomplish or what they wanted to accomplish? What do you think, starting with you, John?
Well, I think they did. I think DeSantis in the second debate that occurred, you know, 3 days after the first debate, basically it's one where he now was fortified with these freshly released texts, emails, and other documents that stem from this ethics investigation of a complaint against Gillum for taking a trip with a lobbyist friend to Costa Rica and another to New York, with that New York trip, of course, featuring a ticket to Hamilton that we now know was provided by an undercover FBI agent posing as a developer interested in doing business in Tallahassee. You know, that just allowed DeSantis to tee off on Gillum as corrupt. Gillum, you know, he kind of downplayed that document release. He's definitely on the defense on this issue, and this is going to continue in the closing weeks of this campaign, I think. He said that his only mistake was, quote, not asking more questions. He thought the ticket was from his brother, Marcus, who had traded it with the lobbyist friend, Adam Corey. And none of that, however, is mentioned in the documents that were released this week.
Right. I think we have a clip of Andrew Gillum offering a little bit. I mean, he was pretty defiant up until the Wednesday's debate. He kind of offered a semi-apology or concession or explanation about the ticket. Thomas Cordy's going to cue that one up for us.
That Adam Corey and Mike Miller arranged so that we could go and see the show. I arrived at the theater and received my ticket from my brother. The problem that I have is that I should have asked more questions to make sure that everything that had transpired was above board. I was informed by my brother at the time that he gave Adam Corey tickets to a Jay-Z Beyonce concert, of which I understand they took later. And I understood that to have solved whatever the issue was with regards to the expenses associated with it. But I take responsibility for not having asked more questions. But let me tell you, I'm running for governor. In the state of Florida, we got a lot of issues. In fact, we got 99 issues, and Hamilton ain't one of them.
There you go. Dropping a little Jay-Z reference there at the end. Now, his explanation, the thing about his brother, is there's no mention of that explanation in the text messages that came out. They say Adam Corey, his lobbyist friend, saying, hey, Mike Miller has hooked us up with Hamilton tickets. And a little later, Andrew Gillum texts back, that would be awesome. So it was interesting that he, you know, conceded, well, maybe I should have asked a few more questions about it. And then I thought what he said at the end, though, was basically he's, you know, certainly trying to minimize the significance of the Hamilton ticket in the larger context of a governor's race. Zach Anderson, do you think he handled that effectively?
Or do you think Gillum handled it effectively? Yeah, I think he deflected it pretty well. You know, to me, this debate, both of these debates were more important for DeSantis than for Gillum. You know, there has been no publicly released poll that has shown DeSantis leading. So when you're the underdog, the debates are always more important for you. You want to come out and have a strong performance. You know, DeSantis has actually had to shake up his campaign. He brought in a new campaign consultant because, you know, he was trailing. And so he's trying to project an image of strength, trying to project some confidence and get his supporters fired up. I think he did pretty much everything that he could. He was very aggressive. He went after Gillum. He tried to hammer home the FBI thing. I thought he did his best to try and counteract the accusation that he's racist or that he's associated with racist. At one point, you know, he said Floridians can know that I'll be a governor for all Floridians. That's the only way you can do it. You know, so I think he, you know, had a couple of strong debates. You know, people were maybe nervous about his campaign, Republicans, and I think he showed him that he's a fighter, but I don't know that he knocked Gillum off of his game. I don't know that these debates necessarily change the fundamental dynamics of the race.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, and his, you know, in politics, they say if you're explaining, you're losing. And really, since the first day of the general election campaign, Gillum has spent a lot of time explaining, you know, starting with the monkey this up comment or the contributor that Gillum alluded to that, you know, had used the racial slur against President Obama. You had the robocalls, which DeSantis condemned, and there's no evidence that he's involved in, but these, you know, these racist robocalls. It's just been a series of racially tinged things that DeSantis has had to explain. And Gillum, you know, with that quote, I'm not calling him a racist, but the people who are racist think he is, you know, is a clever way of putting that idea out there without specifically calling him that. So, you know, that's been a big factor for that's been dogging DeSantis throughout the race, just as the FBI and thing in Tallahassee has been dogging Gillum throughout his campaign.
You can tell that it really bugs DeSantis that he's been tagged as a racist. In this last debate, you know, the moderator brought up David Horowitz, who's a far right conservative who hosted a conference that DeSantis went to. And Horowitz has said the only serious race war in this country is against whites. And the moderator asked DeSantis about that comment. And DeSantis, kind of indignant, said, how the hell am I supposed to know every single statement that somebody makes? I'm not going to bow to the altar of political correctness. So you could tell that this has really bugged him and kind of got under his skin a little bit.
Yeah, and that was the comment when DeSantis blew up about that, and then Gillum had that response about the hit dog will holler was his kind of cool response to the very hot DeSantis answer about the Horowitz thing.
I wonder too about the hot response from DeSantis. Is that stage anger too? Because we've seen, you know, this would basically be DeSantis's mentor Donald Trump using a lot of those same kind of muscle it up kind of responses to political correctness or whatever it might be, and that seems to send a real signal out there to voters that that like him, that he's ready to go toe to toe with a lot of these critics. So maybe that's what DeSantis is trying to play too, by showing off a little bit of anger there.
There you go. Well, so and just to put a bow on it, and then we'll go to another segment. But speaking of Donald Trump, shortly before the Wednesday night debate, it was announced that President Trump will be coming to Fort Myers on October 31st, Halloween, to do a rally Ron DeSantis will be there. Rick Scott, the Republican nominee for Senate, his campaign said that Scott is focused on the hurricane. So it sounds like Rick Scott, who has been keeping his distance from President Trump, might not be showing up at that Halloween Trump rally. So the purpose of a rally like that is to obviously people have strong opinions about Donald Trump, and you're not going to win any Democratic votes, persuade any Democrats to vote for you by having Donald Trump come down for a rally. Obviously, you do something like that to fire up your own voters, your own base. And John Kennedy, you have been doing some reporting on the GOTV, Get Out the Vote efforts by both the Republicans and Democrats. Tell us a little bit about what you are finding.
Well, this really is the time period now as the election nears, you know, where you have both Democrats and Republicans pretty much, chest thumping right now about their turnout efforts, both seemingly feeling pretty good about what they're, you know, what they've got going out there across the state. Republicans say they have 90 paid staff on the ground, 3,000 volunteers around the state. And that's not including some of these allied organizations like the Libre Initiative, which is focused on Hispanic voters, and to a degree, the Koch brothers backed Americans for Prosperity, which are both doing get out the vote efforts right now, many of them in support of Republican initiatives, Republican candidates. Republicans say they've made 4 million voter contacts in Florida. That's 3 weeks ahead of the pace they were on in 2016. Democrats, however, say they can outdo that. They say that they've had 9 million voter contacts. And, this is everything from text messages to door knocking to some kind of personal connection between a volunteer, presumably, and a prospective voter. Democrats have seemingly more allied groups and volunteers out there right now. Unions, another organization, For Our Future, which is heavily financed by billionaire Tom Steyer and supported by unions. Next Gen America, they're all targeting young and minority voters and what they call sporadic voters. These are people who don't show up for every election, especially midterms, but they are really, you know, much in demand this time around. In some of the reporting I've done on this, I've learned, you know, it's remarkable that the Florida Democratic Party has even been able to get out the vote messages sent to Puerto Rican transplants now in Florida by buying advertising data from companies that advertise on the online game Candy Crush. They found people that played Candy Crush in Puerto Rico before Hurricane Maria and are now in Florida, you know, and presumably still playing Candy Crush.
The Candy Crush demographic has long been overlooked in Florida politics, so they might be on something.
Exactly. Not this time around. It looks like they're trying to really, you know, capitalize on that. So it's pretty crazy. Meanwhile, both sides are, you know, parsing the early and absentee voting, with Republicans saying they're ahead of totals and absentee voters from 2014, which they consider to be a real, you know, marquee year for them in Florida. Democrats say that counties where they're strongest are slow to report a lot of these absentee numbers, but that they've added this number, 582,000 Democrats to the vote by mail rolls. That's been over the past 5 months. And when those voters come in, Democrats think they're going to win. What's an unknown in all this, though, is whether these early voters just take away from voters on November 6th, Election Day. You know, is one side going to max out their voting base earlier than the other? But it's clear in races like the Florida governor's race and the U.S. Senate race, where, you know, you have Governor Rick Scott versus Democrat Bill Nelson, that there's less than 10% of the electorate that's undecided or persuadable right now. So it really suggests that this is going to come down to who comes out. And there's not a lot of unknowns out there.
Yeah, as we're taping this podcast, about 1.7 million or more Floridians have already voted, and so far about 43% of the ballots turned in have been from Republicans, and about 40% maybe from Democrats. And as you mentioned, John, that over the years we've seen just the way that people vote has changed, more and more people taking advantage of early voting or mail voting, and so with each election, you see these numbers, and you can, on one hand, you can try to, you know, find significance in it, but on the other hand, you don't know how much of that is just more people taking advantage of the convenience that would have otherwise voted on Election Day. The other thing I would just say, from years of covering elections, the ground game is one of those things that, you know, you talk about lies in politics. Everybody lies about their ground game. Everybody always says they have the greatest ground game ever. And then, you know, the proof is on Election Day. So there are some interesting numbers you mentioned on both sides, and both sides can find some positive notes, reasons for optimism heading into these elections. Zach Anderson, anything you've observed on the ground game over there in your part of the state?
Yeah, there's aggressive efforts, as John said. I mean, it you see a lot of activity on the ground here. Obviously, turnout is always a big deal, and especially so in the last few election cycles, where you know it seems like persuading people has taken a backseat to just turning out your supporters. You know, you see Trump going to Southwest Florida. That's a huge Republican area, and if you can get the vote out there, you know, Republicans have a pretty good shot. You saw in the last presidential election where it was really focused on turnout. Clinton was aggressive in trying to turn out Democratic voters in some of the urban areas of Florida, but the Trump team did a better job of turning out people in the suburban and rural areas. And it seems like that's exactly what they're doing in this cycle as well, with Trump going to, suburban Southwest Florida and trying to fire up a deep red area.
Yeah, for what it's worth, in 2016, you know, going around and trying to measure the ground game, the Clinton campaign in 2016 in Florida put on a more impressive show of appearing to have all these offices and people coming in and out of them and just looking like they had a much more organized ground game. But, you know, she lost the state by 1.2%. And speaking of numbers, I'm hearing that funky royalty-free music again. That means it's time to return to our Pick a Number segment. I know that as much as everyone has enjoyed the wisdom we've been dropping here in this podcast, you've really been waiting to hear what those numbers mean. Let's go lowest to highest today. Zach Anderson, you had the number 54. Can you explain that to us, please?
Yeah, George, I mentioned earlier in the podcast that Gillum has not been trailing in any publicly released polls that I'm aware of. And we had a bunch more out this week that showed him in the lead. Some of them, one of them, I think, showed him with a lead of just 1 point, others upwards of double digits. One of the more interesting polls that I saw was a Quinnipiac poll. And I just picked out the number 54 because that is the number, the percentage that DeSantis is winning with white voters. Why am I picking out a percentage that he's winning when I was talking about Gillum leading in all these polls? Well, Trump won white voters in Florida by 64%, and DeSantis is only winning them by 54%. So a 10-point swing there. You know, there's been a lot of talk about Gillum being the first African-American governor of Florida, potentially, and him firing up African-American voters. And that certainly seems to be the case. In this Quinnipiac poll, he was getting 99% of the African-American vote compared to 1% for DeSantis. He was also leading amongst women by a greater margin than Trump lost women in Florida. So, you know, he's doing well in all these demographics, but it's interesting to see the white vote in particular, with all the focus on race and the racial issue in this governor's race and talk that some of the language from DeSantis, this monkey this up comment, was maybe a racial dog whistle intended to get white voters on his side. If that was the case, it doesn't appear to be working according to this Q poll, because he's not leading white voters by the margin that you would need to win this state, at least according to this one poll.
Interesting. Well, just to continue the racial theme, my number 63.2, that is the percentage of white voters in Florida. And that's down from 64.2. It's down a point from 2016. And if you go back to 2006, that was the first year that Florida categorized voters by race the way they do now. The percentage of white voters in 2006 was 72%. So in 12 years, it's gone from 72% to 63.2%. The big growth in that time has been Hispanic voters. Just in 12 years, they've gone from 10.7% of the electorate to 16.5% now. So it's all just an illustration of the changing demographics in Florida. And our final number is 107 from John Kennedy. Tell us more about that three-digit number.
Yeah. Well, 107 is 107 million, and that's what's been spent overall in the Florida U.S. Senate race as of this week. And that makes it the most expensive in the nation, at least according to advertising analytics, which tracks real-time spending in these political races. They, at 107 million, the Bill Nelson-Rick Scott race is well ahead of the second costliest race, which is the Nevada Senate race between incumbent Republican Dean Heller, who's seeking a second term, and Democrat Jackie Rosen. They've combined, they spent, well, a paltry $72 million. And, you know, not, I guess not to be outdone, the Florida governor's race is right up there, too. Second in the nation with $51 million in spending, second only to the Illinois race for governor between that's a Republican, Bruce Rauner, and Democrat J.B. Pritzker. Florida is near the top.
That's a lot of money going to local TV stations. Okay, well, thank you for those numbers. And that concludes another one of our Inside Florida Politics podcasts. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. It's been my honor to be your host today. I'm joined here in West Palm Beach by the indispensable help of Corzano. That's the team of Thomas Cordy and Joe Corzano. We've also had John Kennedy from Tallahassee, the State Capitol Bureau Chief for Gatehouse Media. And from Sarasota, Zach Anderson, the Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor. And of course, the digital audio production director from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, aka the man behind the curtain, Adam Fish. Thank you.